right up front, I need to admit something. I am a bit uneasy embarking on the conversation we're about to begin with Dr. Arthur Hunt, not because I disagree with any of his facts or his conclusions, but because we are bringing this conversation to you via the medium of radio. And radio is it's a medium that, like all media, be they television or the typewritten word or the spoken word, has its certain limitations, it has its certain strengths. And in the course of this conversation, we're going to be discussing simple things like whether or not the technology by which information is communicated between people itself leaves that information untouched and unblemished, or whether or not the medium or the media, as the case may be, is not in fact neutral, but shapes the message which it delivers. It's one of the basic questions we're going to deal with in this part one of a three-part series on an image-based culture versus a word-based culture. Now, one might argue that radio is still word-based, and maybe we will. We will be talking a lot about an image-based culture. What is the danger of becoming not only based upon images as a culture, but dependent upon images as a culture, as opposed to a culture that is dependent upon word, be it spoken or written? We'll talk about that during this hour of Issues, Etc. You can join us if you wish. Our call-in number, 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Arthur Hunt received his Ph.D. in communications from the University of Southern Mississippi. He is author of the new book titled The Vanishing Word, The Veneration of Visual Imagery in the Postmodern World. Dr. Hunt, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Good afternoon, Todd. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
People have been talking about this particular subject for a long time. Probably the guy who got the ball rolling is the well-known Marshall McLuhan, who is probably most famous for his simple statement, "The medium is the message." What did McLuhan mean there, and how does that bear upon the situation we find ourselves in today in a image-based culture?
Well, you know, Marshall McLuhan, the Canadian communication theorist, was somewhat of a guru back in the 1960s because he was writing on this issue. And evangelicals, I think, have not totally picked up on some of the things that he was saying until, I think, recently. Evangelicals have embraced electronic media just like they embraced the printing press. But I don't think that we as Christians have sometimes stopped to realize that print-based technology is a little bit different from image-based technology. Marshall McLuhan said that the medium is the message, and what he meant by that is we should not only be concerned with the content of media, but we also should be concerned with how media shapes our environment. And so that's what he was really saying.
Well, okay, lay out the situation for us by giving us a concrete example of what McLuhan meant when he said the medium is the message, how you agree with this, and the situation we find ourselves in.
Well, I think it's probably important to go all the way back to the invention of the printing press. One could make the argument that the printing press helped hurl Europe out of the Middle Ages and into the Protestant Reformation. The Protestant Reformation made very good use of the printing press. In fact, it was almost overnight that Luther's ideas became known throughout Germany. And print was a technology in which you could analyze something, you could scrutinize it, you could look at it very carefully. It fueled the Protestant Reformation. So in a sense, we could say that print technology harnessed with the Protestant Reformation brought about sweeping changes because it got the written word into the hands of the common people through sermons and through the publication of Bibles. Marshall McLuhan, who wrote about this issue in the 60s, was very aware that television was was shaping the culture. And of course, Marshall McLuhan was also known for his coinage of the term the global village. One of the arguments that he made was that with communication technologies, with us connecting around the world is shrinking because of our fast, rapid communication, our electronic communication. He also made the point that images are more closely aligned, and what happens in an image-based culture is more closely aligned with oral societies, which is where you have people telling stories around an open fire. There have been other people who have played off of ideas of Marshall McLuhan, Neil Postman being one of them. And my book, in part, I give some recognition and acknowledgement to Postman and how he shaped some of my own ideas.
I have to give, you know, equal credit there, because after reading Amusing Ourselves to Death about, I guess it's about 12 years ago now, I have never watched television the same way, and never really been able to think about a newspaper or even a radio program in the same way. Trying always to be aware of the degree to which the medium is shaping the message. Let's talk about it then in terms of technology. Mm-hmm. Someone's going to say, look, you got a radio transmitter, a microphone, and everything you need to get, and a receiver, everything you need to get the radio broadcast signal out. The same thing for television, maybe even the internet. You got things wired in, so all you've got is really wires and devices in between one person and another. It's just an extension of the human voice or of the human ability to see. The technology itself is neutral. How do you respond?
Yeah. Well, let me first of all say that I am not a technological determinist. Being a Christian myself, I believe that God rules the heavens and the earth. However, I think it should be said that often we don't realize how technologies shape our culture. I think what most often escapes our notice in public discussions is how that new technologies create unintended effects. So in this sense, technology is really a mixed blessing to societies. You know, whether we're talking about the machines of warfare, whether we're talking about transportation or communication media. As I mentioned before, the printing press helped hurl Europe out of the Middle Ages and into the Protestant Reformation. And to some extent, when we look at the Protestant Reformation, there were other benefits to that. Liberty, freedom, discovery, democracy. Those are benefits. You think about the automobile, for example. I'm very grateful for the automobile and what it has allowed for us. It allows us to commute to work. It allows for us to be a more mobile society. But at the same time, scholars have made the assertion that the automobile has also helped create modern-day suburbia. It also has helped chop off the front porch off of our house. Henry Ford, when he formulated the assembly line, he probably did not envision himself to a villain of virginity, but nevertheless, in making the automobile a commodity, he moved courtship from the parlor to the back seat. So the way we conducted our courtship here in America changed when the automobile was invented. And we can go on and on and on about these unintended effects of technology, how that sometimes technology will give us blessings, but at the same time, it can also give us a downside of certain things. And many times, we don't talk about that downside because here in America, progress is always attributed with success and good. We always think of technological progress as being good.
Now, it strikes me that at this very moment, there's a confluence of technologies at work in what we're doing. You and I are sitting in rooms. Technology is doing its passive work, or maybe even its active work between us. But there are people who are driving in the car, you mentioned the car, mm-hmm. listening to us on their radios, another medium there, and perhaps and that's the majority of the listeners during this time of the day,
mm-hmm.
and which 50 years ago, they didn't know what listening to the car on the radio was all about.
No, 50 years ago, they wouldn't have been driving in their cars on such a long commute. But nevertheless, I think one of the good things about radio is that, talk shows like like the one that you have, that's a good thing. Radio is a bit different from television in that you have to pay attention to it. Television is more passive. In other words, radio is somewhat what McLuhan would call a hot medium, because you have to engage it, you have to listen carefully, and you also use your imagination when you listen to radio, especially when you're listening to someone talk on the radio.
Now, let's talk about that word-based culture, because we're bumping up against it repeatedly here, and let's start with something rather concrete, and please excuse the pun. Is it anything more than mere convenience or coincidence that when God communicated divine revelation on Sinai to Moses, that he did it not only speaking the word, but also recording the word etched in stone?
Yeah, boy, that is such an important question today. I believe, and I mentioned this in my book, that when God took the initiative to reach down to mankind, it was not a mistake that he chose the medium of writing to make himself known. I think when you think about the very notion of divine revelation, the communication of truth that cannot otherwise be known, what we would think of as special revelation, it really demands a method of documentation that goes beyond orality or pictorial representation or smoke signals. If one believes that revelation is God-breathed, that each word of Scripture originates from the mind of God, then writing is the obvious choice, because no other medium possesses the objectivity and the permanency needed to tell that old, old story.
God also, in those commands etched in stone, forbade images.
Mm-hmm.
Was, I don't want to make it sound trite, but was he in a sense anticipating the potential danger of divine revelation via the visual image?
It's interesting when you study the history of Israel, you see this tension between the word and the image. Of course, pagan cultures that Israel rubbed shoulders with was image-based with its pagan idolatry. However, I think in contrast, the Jews, the Hebrews, they were to be a word-based culture, because they were to be the ones who were handling God's word, who were making sure that it got transmitted down through the ages. And what's really interesting is that it was the Hebrews which saw to it that their entire society could read. And you contrast that with paganism, not to say that pagan cultures didn't have reading and writing, but their reading and writing was more restricted to a privileged class as opposed to everyone reading. Israel is known for their universal literacy, and so there's this contrast with paganism and then a word-based religion. And Christianity and Judaism is word-based. We can't live without it.
You quote from Neil Postman, author of Amusing Ourselves to Death, "The God of the Jews was to exist in the Word and through the Word, an unprecedented conception requiring the highest order of abstract thinking. Iconography, or images, thus became blasphemy, so that a new kind of God could enter a culture." Now, Postman is obviously writing as a non-Christian, making a mere observation here.
Right.
But what is he saying?
Well, of course, Neil Postman His background is Jewish, so he knows what he's talking about when he talks about this. What he was saying was that in order to talk about an invisible God, you cannot just do that with images. You have to have a medium which is conducive to that, and only the written word is conducive to describe an abstract divinity, one in which is sovereign, one in which is very concerned about his creation and those that he created, one who has a divine plan of redemption and salvation. And you just cannot talk about an abstract divinity and all the intricacies of that type of a God with blocks of paint.
What role has, you mentioned literacy before, and the almost the de facto requirement of literacy among the Israelites in the ancient worshipers of God.
Mm-hmm.
What has been the role of literacy in the with the advent of Christianity in Western culture?
Well, of course, Christianity is a continuation of, to some extent, of the Jewish heritage. However, we also must remember that Christians took what they could in pagan society and in a Hellenistic culture and made it their own, so long as they felt like it was not antagonistic against the faith. So you don't have Christians totally rejecting all pagan texts. What you have is a close scrutiny of what the pagans wrote.
So, for example, St. Paul is familiar with the poets.
I think Paul was very familiar with Hellenistic culture, and in fact, adopted principles of, say, rhetoric into preaching. When you look at Christian preaching today, you cannot divorce it from the rhetoric of ancient Greece and Rome in that tradition. And so I think Christians embraced what was the best of pagan culture and used it for their own, primarily to advance the faith, advance the faith and defend the faith.
Now, someone is going to say, all right, Dr. Hunt, Christians today are really no different. What we're doing is we're taking the best of the technological advancements around us and we're using them in service of the faith. Does mm-hmm. that statement betray some naivete?
I think it is somewhat naive. You have to understand that Americans are very pragmatic, utilitarian. They try to take what is out there in the culture and make it Christian. Often they just baptize it, just like the pagans did when, as we move into the Dark Ages, we saw Christians baptizing pagan temples, and then all of a sudden, overnight, these pagan temples became places for Christian worship. But what a lot of people don't realize is that these temples, these pagan temples, still have some of the ethos of paganism. Many people in the Dark Ages, when they became Christians, they became Christian in name only because their conversion was, I think, to some degree, many times suspect because of the inducements given for conversion. So you have many people under the banner of Christianity who were increasingly becoming less and less literate, and you had the power of the church growing and almost coercing people into the faith. And when you have that type of I don't want to call it evangelism, that type of urging into the faith, I think that you have people who don't know the faith, who are in Christian only Christian in name only, and yet they they still have their pagan tendencies attached with them, so it was very hard for them to just suddenly overnight go into a temple where they had been worshiping Zeus the day before, and now they are to worship Christ. It was difficult for them, and that's why you have this mixture in the Dark Ages of paganism and Christianity existing, coexisting together, this mix. And I think that today we want to embrace, Christians have a tendency to want to embrace popular culture without thinking through what it's going to do to our word-based faith. Of course, the point that I make in my book is that we are very much an image-based culture now. We're becoming more and more so. We swim in images, and you cannot just grab what's out there in the culture and call it Christian and say, hey, we're pleasing God with what we're doing, because we're getting away from the Word. Thus, the title, The Vanishing Word.
What is I'm thinking, I guess, of an example of a medium that has found its way into the Sunday morning context of worship for the Christian church, and whether or not it brings with it the potential to change the message, or at the very least to nuance the message, and that is the kind of the Jumbotron screen. We have a visual culture. If we put a big screen at the front of the church, not only can we flash our song lyrics up there, but we can also, in the course of a sermon, present some images that may elucidate the message with about a minute and a half. Your concerns there, if any?
Well, it's not uncommon in most large churches today to find a big screen. And, you know, I see nothing immoral or wrong with that, especially if you're sitting hundreds and hundreds of feet back. You want to be able to see the preacher. So the way we do that is we amplify the preacher by putting his image up on a large screen, and that can be very helpful, especially, you know, if we can't see. However, many churches now are using the screens also to advertise things going on in the church, and to some extent even supplementing some of the content of the sermon with video clips. It is a type of accommodation to the technology that we have, and I think many evangelicals are very sincere in trying to embrace this technology. But at the same time, I think that we cannot get away from the written as well as the primacy of the spoken word, both the primacy of the written and the spoken word in worship. And of course, there are other types of accommodations as well that I discuss in my book.
Let's talk about a few of those things when we come back and extend this just a bit with Dr. Arthur Hunt. Our guest is author of the new book titled The Vanishing Word, The Veneration of Visual Imagery in the Postmodern World. This is part one of a three-part series on an image-based culture versus a word-based culture. Well, the church exists as, if nothing more, of course, a word-based culture. We have our genesis in the Word, we have our truth and our solid foundation in the Word. When we introduce the technology, do we bring other considerations to bear as well? We'll be right back.
The radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
What does the truly spiritual life look like? How is it lived? Do the stations we occupy in life, father, mother, husband, wife, employee, citizen, do these have anything to do with our spiritual life? What is the Christian doctrine of vocation? Find out how God hides himself in the ordinary tasks of life in the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for May, The Spirituality of the Cross by Dr. Gene Edward Veith. You can order The Spirituality of the Cross by calling Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. When you call, ask for the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for May, or order online at issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section and you'll find information on this book.
PhD in Geology, Stumped by Creation.
Answers with Ken Ham, author of the children's book, Dinosaurs of Eden.
Well, Ken, what exactly stumped this evolutionary geologist?
Well, I don't usually go around seeking geologists to debate evolution, but at a recent conference, a geologist came up after my talk. He seemed very concerned and said, "You're a powerful speaker. You're convincing people all over the world that the Bible teaches the Earth's only a few thousand years old. But the Bible isn't black and white, it's shades of grey. The word day could mean millions of years." I said, "Could you show me Genesis chapter 1 where it says day means long periods of time?" And he said, "But who wrote it anyway?" "Ah," I said, "now we get to the real problem. You don't believe it's the inspired word of God, do you?" "Well, what does it mean to be inspired?" he asked. "Oh, I see," I said. "You just don't want to believe what the Bible says. You haven't even thought through what the Bible really says." Well, this went on and on. It was obvious he didn't want to know the answers. He just walked away. You know, this incident reminded me about the Apostle Peter, where he said that men are willingly ignorant about creation. It's not their education or PhD that really keeps them ultimately from accepting what the Bible says. It's just they don't want to believe because of their sin nature.
Don't all scientists believe that carbon dating shows that the Bible is wrong about the age of the Earth? Well, our free booklet tells the entire story. Read it on our popular and easy-to-use website. That's AnswersRadio.com.
:31 at AM 850 KFUO. Weather for St. Louis. Overnight partly cloudy, a chance for rain, low of about 62. For Tuesday, partly sunny, a high near 79. A nice afternoon on the way tomorrow once again. Currently mostly clear and 82 in St. Louis. Another look at St. Louis traffic. Westbound 40 between Clayton, Skinker, and Big Bend Boulevard. Slow traffic, then heavy and slow from Spady to Maryville. Southbound 270 between Ladue Road and 40. Slow traffic in the right lane, then heavy on out to Doherty Ferry. Northbound 270 between Page Avenue and Dorset Road. Slow traffic in the right lane and in the right lanes exiting onto westbound 70. Eastbound 40 between Jefferson and the Poplar Street Bridge. Slow traffic there. And northbound 55 between Park Avenue and the Poplar Street Bridge. Slow traffic in the right lane. That's traffic and weather on AM 850 KFUO. I'm Craig Allen. AM 850 KFUO has a great way for you to get the word out about your church. Become an AM 850 KFUO Church of the Week. In exchange for a financial gift, your congregation has 35 personalized messages throughout the week. That's five a day. We also recognize your congregation once an hour as the Church of the Week, and your pastor is featured on the morning show. For more information, contact Janelle Flerke at 1-888-930-4438.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're in the middle of part one of a three-part series on an image-based culture versus a word-based culture. Dr. Arthur Hunt, author of the book The Vanishing Word, The Veneration of Visual Imagery in the Postmodern World, is our guest. Now, you can purchase this new book directly through our radio program. We will send you the book for a contribution of $15 to Issues Etc. The price includes shipping and handling. Just have your MasterCard, your Visa, or your Discover card ready and call the Issues Etc. resource line. The number is 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. The book you ask for is called The Vanishing Word by Dr. Arthur Hunt, or you can make a $15 check payable to Issues Etc. and mail it to Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. That's Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. The phone number again, our automated resource line, 1-800-737-0172. Dr. Hunt, one more question on the introduction of the media of visual imagery into the life of the church. Back to the big screen in the church, mm-hmm. For Sunday morning. It seems to its presence might create a sense of necessity. In other words, at the very least, having it might induce everyone there to say, "Look, we've got the thing. We don't want it just to sit there idle. We need to find a way to use it, and that means we need to find images to project for everyone to see."
Oh, there's no doubt about that. Unless church practices some restraint, that's exactly what will happen and what is happening. Don't want to use it for many infomercials for the church, A lot of times there will be an activity, of course, and that'll be videotaped, and then before service that will be shown an edited version of that activity. I think the thought behind that is that it creates a sense of community. It shows, hey, this is what we're doing. But to some extent, I think when it boils right down to it, it's the church looking into a mirror thing, and we're looking at ourselves. Well, and I'm not sure if worship needs to be so narcissistic.
I liken it to going to a movie theater, and granted, the lights are not dimmed, or maybe they are, for all I know, for better visual acuity. But given the fact that churches are looking more and more like the theater themselves, I don't get a sense of community by going to see the latest Matrix movie with other people. I go, I watch, I leave, and the people around me are essentially irrelevant. It's just like watching television written in large letters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If we distinguish between different media, we were distinguishing between radio and print a while back ago. I think we can also distinguish between cinema and television. I do think that they are different from each other. I think television, we do casually. Of course, there's the interruption of commercials. We may be doing something else when we watch television. I think when we go to a movie, that's a little bit of a different experience in that we are engaged. We are watching. I think cinema is more of an art form or higher art form than television. But even with cinema today, we have the same elements of paganism coming to the forefront, and that is an adoration of sex and violence, and then of course the cult of celebrity, which surrounds not only the movie industry but also the television industry.
We tend to associate the appearance of someone on a screen with celebrity or with importance, because we see important people on television or on movie screens. The projection of the pastor preaching his sermon in jumbo fashion, does it have the potential to create a cult of personality? After all, I mean, he was on the screen. That's the guy I just saw on the screen.
Or if you've ever watched people watching video clips of a church activity on a church screen and how they are waiting to see themselves, there I am, and there you are. And so while I think churches think that this does somehow build a sense of, when I say community, I mean feeling good about what we're doing. Maybe I should express it like that. Maybe that's not a very good way to look at community, because community is really defined as from the root word of commonness. But I think that what's happening is that we're just looking at ourselves when we do that, which is not unlike our entire society, which, and I use the metaphor, we live in a house of mirrors, in which we are just totally surrounded by images of ourselves. And when I say ourselves, I mean people, and they're different. Personas.
You devote a chapter to talking about the decline of literacy and therefore education. Usually, you mentioned before the Dark Ages,
mm-hmm.
and for all the misrepresentations that exist about the Dark Ages, this one I think does hold true, that literacy was in decline. What was the result of the word vanishing with, well, nothing to take its place during that period of Western history?
Sometime between AD 400 and AD 1000, what we would think of as the analytical elements, which really was embedded to some extent in the Roman culture, it became increasingly diminished. During the Dark Ages, literacy faded, and as a result, education faded. And then, as a result of education fading, civility faded. And because of literacy and education and civility fading, superstition seeped in. which is very characteristic. When we think of the Dark Ages, we think of a superstitious people. And that is not to say that there wasn't some reading and writing, but like with pagan cultures, literacy was restricted to a clerical elitist group of people, to where the common, average, ordinary man did not see or read texts. A historian by the name of Harry Gaff says that in the second half of the first millennium, that the reduction of literate man in the West coincided with the great swellings within the Roman Catholic Church brought on by the conversions of the barbarians. And of course, the barbarians were not readers. Another historian, Kenneth Clark, says that for 500 years, the ability to read and write was practically unknown, not only to the average layperson, but also the kings and emperors.
So what made the change? What drew Western culture out of the quagmire of illiteracy?
Well, I think there are a couple of things that we can attribute to illiteracy in the Dark Ages. First of all, and Neil Postman, I think, points this out quite well. First of all, he says the alphabet became disguised as styles multiplied. In other words, the fashion was to make letters elaborate to the point of almost making them unrecognizable. Another reason, though, is that for the fading of literacy is because of the scarcity of parchment and paper to write upon. But I think there's one third reason, which is probably more predominant, more important, and that is, simply stated, reading and writing were restricted by the church. And so you had a world that lived without facts. And since all knowledge was had to be either experienced or observed or based upon word of mouth, it came to the point where the written word was to some degree held in suspect. Records were rarely kept, and since there were few calendars and clocks, one marked the passage of time with the seasons and the events. And really, in many medieval villages, it was almost like an island world where there was no sense of history, no sense of geography, no sense of science. And because human communication was primarily oral, and because there were few books and few facts, no general body of knowledge about the past or the present state of the world to transmit to others, there was really little reason for reading books or reason for a formal system of education. Of course, there was some private tutoring, but primarily education, where a child develops the skills of reading and writing ellipsed during the Dark Ages.
Now, you mentioned that the church had a hand in this decline. What was the result for the church during this time, complicitous as it was?
Well, that's a good question. I think one could make the point, and I don't want to be offensive, but I think that to some extent you can control people when they are not able to read and write, because they lose the power of critical thinking. They lose the power of analyzing situations, and so basically you're just told what to do. And so there was some power in being able to just or keeping people from the written word, a certain amount of control over the masses. And when you want to exercise control over large populations, keeping them illiterate is one good way to do that.
You quote Luther early in the book in anticipation of a later chapter, mm-hmm. calling the invention of the printing press by Gutenberg to be, quote, the supreme act of grace by which the gospel can be driven forward. You go even farther than that. You credit Gutenberg with three significant word-based movements, not only the Protestant Reformation, but also Puritanism and the American experiment. Let's very briefly, in the time remaining to us, take each one of those in turn. The Protestant Reformation, was it as much of Gutenberg as it was of Luther and Calvin?
Well, I think Luther and Calvin and Tyndale and Erasmus, who really wasn't, we can't credit him as being a reformer, but I think that without the printing press, the fire of the Reformation would not have been able to spread like it did so rapidly. Historian Elizabeth Eisenstein notes in her book, The Printing Revolution in Early Modern Europe, and this is a quote, and I think it's a wonderful quote. She said, Luther had invited a public disputation, and nobody had come to dispute. Then, by a stroke of magic, he found himself addressing the world. And of course, that was being aided by the printing press. So the story of the Protestant Reformation is really a story of how printers and booksellers were enlisted to bypass the priests and place the gospel message directly into the hands of the public. And so for the first time, not that we had not had pre-reformers, but now with the printing press, we see reform transpiring at speeds unknown before Gutenberg's press.
And the rise of Puritanism, how did Gutenberg's invention of the printing press and its production throughout Europe bring about the rise of Puritanism, which is obviously another very significant religious event in Western history?
You know, the Puritans have really gotten a bad rap. And I'd like to resurrect them a little bit, and I hope that more people will start doing that. We really can't afford to hate the Puritans without hating ourselves. If it can be said that American democracy got off on a good foot, then we have to acknowledge that it was a Puritan foot. Because, and here's a very interesting statistic that I use in my book, when America declared her independence in 1776, as much as 75% of the revolutionary dissent came from our Puritan heritage. And the Puritans were whether we realize it or not, were quite bookish. They were literate. In fact, New England had some of the highest rates of literacy during the 1600s. And so they were certainly not anti-education, but very pro-education, teaching their children how to read, making it law that children must learn how to read. So they were very serious about reading, the Puritans were. Now here's an interesting account etched in the record at Harvard that I'll quote for you, the Puritans are known for. After God had carried us safely to New England, and we had built our houses, provided necessaries for our livelihood, reared convenient places for God's worship, and settled the civil government, one of the next things we longed for and looked after was to advance learning and perpetuate it to posterity, dreading to leave an illiterate ministry to the churches when our present ministries shall lie in dust. And you know, that quote reveals some interesting thing about the Puritans. First of all, it shows that education was very important to them, that it ranked as high as food and shelter and worship and establishing a government. But it also suggests that the Puritans were looking down a very long road and that they were building a society for the future. But I think most importantly, it shows their utter disgust for a stupid clergy. The Puritans were truly people of the word, people of the book.
And finally, you mentioned the American experiment as being one of the direct offspring of Gutenberg's printing press. Tell us about that.
I like the phrase that Neil Postman uses when he describes the type of information environment that America had at its very beginning. He uses the phrase typographic mind, and Postman says that early Americans possessed a typographic mind. And what did he mean by that? Well, he meant that it was a mind that was shaped by the habit of reading. Postman says that early Americans submitted to the sovereignty of the printing press. The typographic mind was a mind that had a sophisticated ability to think conceptually, deductively, and sequentially. It had a high valuation of reason and order. It had an abhorrence of contradiction and a large capacity for detachment and objectivity and a tolerance for delayed response, end quote. So that's who we were, and I'm not so sure that we are the same type of people today. That is not to say that we don't have information today. We have plenty of information, lots of it, but sometimes the problem is too much information and knowing what to do with it. Most Americans get their news from television today, and as I point out in the book, television has a certain bias toward information in that it has to present it in a very show biz way in order to maintain the attention of the viewer. I mentioned Postman just a moment ago. Of course, his main thesis in his book, Amusing Ourselves to Death, is that television is not a very good medium to conduct serious public discourse because it's primarily a medium of amusement.
Now, I guess in that vein, I wonder, you had mentioned, now television has become interactive. You can email someone on television right then and there and at least get a sense of interaction with Bill O'Reilly or someone else on television who are there giving us infotainment. I think about email. You mentioned mm-hmm. the tolerance for delayed response.
Right.
There was a time when if you wrote someone, you knew it would be a week or more before you heard a response. And then, of course, if you had something to say, you had to actually sit down and write it in a careful fashion with pen and ink. What is the advent of instant messaging, the internet, and in particular email, done to human communication that is written, but the medium seems to have changed the way we do this?
That's very interesting. I was just reading the other week a book by Michael Horton, Where in the World is the Church?
It's a great book.
Yeah, good book. And I thought it was interesting that he was talking about this and how that, of course, he went to school over in Oxford, England, and he often would email his friends that he went to school with. I would think that it would be acquaintances that he had made at school. But he contrasted his own emailing with the fact that his British counterparts thought that it was a bit unusual. In fact, they took the time to write out a letter and send it to him, taking time to write neatly, and spending time with the message, and realizing that I don't need to get my message there in 3 seconds. There's some virtue in taking time to sit down and write a letter and think about it rather than tapping off a message instantaneously. And I have a computer and I have email, and we were talking about the benefits of technologies, and I think one benefit of the internet is that I know I communicate probably with more people who are not who are 100 miles outside of my own radius than I used to because of the convenience of the internet. But at the same time, to be honest with you, I don't think that that we are a people who sit down and take much time to write letters anymore. Not that we don't do that at all, or not that there aren't people who do that. But as a whole, and we could talk about the invention of the telephone as well, which also, I think, led to people not writing letters, telephone as well as the internet. We just don't do that. We're not thoughtful and reflective. You know, 100 years ago, 200 years ago, it was not unusual for people to sit down at the end of the day and open a book with blank pages and write about the events of the day and think about, reflecting about what had transpired during the day in a journal. And we don't do that very much anymore either.
With only 30 seconds here before we have to go, on the whole, and this anticipates our future conversations in this series, on the whole, has technology been a boon or a bane to the church so far in our flirting with technology in the various media?
I think technology was a great asset to the church with the invention of the printing press. But with the advent of image-based media, I think the embracing of that technology is presenting some downsides or some consequences which I think are going to have a negative impact in the long run, simply because we are to be a people of the book, and that words are vital for our faith.
We'll explore that more in the following parts of this three-part series on an image-based culture versus a word-based culture with Dr. Arthur Hunt. Dr. Hunt, thank you again for being our guest on Issues, Etc.
Thank you, Todd.
Dr. Arthur Hunt received his Ph.D. in communications from the University of Southern Mississippi, and he has authored the new book titled The Vanishing Word, The Veneration of Visual Imagery in the Postmodern World. Now, if you'd like to receive a complimentary copy of Our Issues, Etc. journal, something to read, folks, I actually put pen to paper to put this thing together, or if you'd like to purchase Dr. Arthur Hunt's new book called The Vanishing Word for a total of $15, or if you'd like to make a donation to Issues, Etc., call our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172, or write Issues, Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Next time we'll be talking about the Industrial Revolution, how it made the big change, and how telegraph, telephone, email, computer, television, radio, all have changed the way we communicate and, in fact, what we communicate as well. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues, Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues, Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.